Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, we'll rock on. My next guest this morning is one of the best-selling authors in the world. He just released a terrific collection of short stories, but his Jack Reacher books that you probably know have sold over 100 million copies. They've spawned Tom Cruise movies. There's a hugely successful TV show now as well. And the funny thing is, none of this would have happened if he didn't get fired from his good job in TV. Lee Child, you're very welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Lee. So listen, before we get to the new book, Safe Enough, I'm conscious that it is September 1st tomorrow, and September 1st is a very significant date for you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great memory you got there, Brendan. Yeah, September the 1st is the day every year that a Reacher book gets started. So, but it's my brother doing it now. I'm stepping back from the actual Reacher books. He's taking over for the future. So, yeah, he'll be beavering away tomorrow. And I'm glad about that.
Does he have to start on September 1st as well, yes? You're keeping up that
yes,
tradition?
Yes, he does. There are certain rules, and that's one of them. You know, you've got to stick to the process.
Okay, so you're still the boss of him, I can see. So
I'm the big brother.
So the reason that September 1st became that date as well is because that is also the date that you lost your job in television, wasn't it? Tell me about, when was that? It was kind of back in the golden days of television, wasn't it?
It was in the middle of the 1990s, and I had a great job. I left that job at Granada TV in Manchester, and it was lovely, lovely company until the last couple of years when they did that 1990s thing. People all over the world experienced the same thing. They just threw you out and got cheaper people or computers or whatever. So I walked up to WH Smith and I bought a paper and a pencil and I wrote that first book as a desperate means to pay my bills. You know, I had no other alternative. And so that's a long time ago now, but I remember it well, sitting down, starting, thinking, can I do it? What lies ahead? It was fantastic.
And how did you decide and have the confidence to think, I'll write books?
It was because I'd been a reader, you know, all my life. I'd been a huge, huge reader. I loved books. I kind of, by that point, had figured out how they work. And it was, I wasn't sure, you know, I played a sort of trick on myself to take the doubt out of it. I said, yeah, this is definitely going to work, which is actually a crazy thing to say because you never know.
Yeah.
But I had to do it that way just to push myself through it. And I loved writing it. I loved writing it in the same way that I love reading a book. So I thought, you know what, this could work because I'm enjoying doing it. And I think the enjoyment that the author puts into it is really important.
And was the extraordinary success a surprise to you?
Yeah, it was, of course. You know, I hoped that it would be an extraordinary success because, of course, you do. You know, you hope it's going to work. But to assume that it will is delusional. You have no idea. It's the most magnificent thing. You know this because of your job. You never know how the public is going to react. You can plan, you can expect, but you never know.
Yeah, you can't control them, can you, Lee? That's the problem with the public.
That's the problem, yeah.
So listen, explain to me then about handing Reacher over to your brother Andrew. How come?
Well, As I said, I was a huge, huge reader. And especially when I was younger, I felt really bad and betrayed by writers that were good for a number of books. And then you get the next one and it's no good. They've run out of energy. They don't care anymore. They're phoning it in. I hated that. And so I made myself a promise. I will never do that. I will never phone it in. If I detect that I'm getting old and tired and running out of energy, then I will stop. And out of respect for my readers, I love my readers. I'm not going to give them a second-rate product. So maybe I was a little hypervigilant, but I felt I was reaching that point, and I asked my brother to take over. And I thought he would say no because he's a very stubborn boy, and he was doing his own stuff, and I thought he's going to say thanks, but no thanks. But he said yes. So it was
And people ask, is it hard to hand him over? And not at all, because really the whole point is to hand him over. What you want after two or three books, you want the readers out there to own the character. He belongs to them. So you are, the whole point of it is to hand it over. So to hand it over to another author who had been involved since day one, I mean, since day zero, actually, Andrew was the first person that ever read my books because I needed somebody who knew about thrillers to give me an opinion. And so he read it when it was still written in pencil. So he's been involved since day zero. So it was pretty natural for him to take over.
But at the same time, brothers are brothers. I know I have brothers. I am a brother. And, you know, we love each other and we get on great and everything. But then if my brother was writing my book and I kind of owned the book, you'd be tempted to interfere. Like, do you interfere a bit?
I try not to. And the thing about Andrew is that he is so much younger than me that we never, ever lived together under the same roof as siblings in that sense. You know, he never broke my toys. I never broke his toys. All those ancient boyhood things that we squabble about never happened with Andrew. With my other brothers, yeah. But Andrew was such a late addition that I didn't know him as a kid, really. Only as he grew up and became a person did we become friends. We're much more friends than brothers. And I totally know what you mean. Brothers drive you crazy. But if you don't have to put up with them as kids, it's a lot better.
Okay. I think you were very protective of him, though. The way, like, if there's a big age difference in brothers, often one can kind of almost become quasi-parental as well. Because I think your dad was a difficult character, was he?
He was. Both of them were difficult, both my mum and dad.
Tell me a bit about them.
They were, well, my dad was from Belfast, and he had this kind of Puritan attitude that anything that there was a danger of pleasure had to be avoided. And my mother was just the same. And it was this gray, boring upbringing. And I felt like a fish out of water. I just wanted to get out of that family. And then much later, I saw Andrew going through the same thing. And it was kind of worse for him because by then, the older boys had grown up and gone. So he was like an only child dealing with all this by himself. So we did, from the age of like 6 years old, we were allies. I would have his back. I remember he was in trouble for something and I sorted it out for him. And I said, don't worry, Andrew, I've got your back. And this little six-year-old piped up and said, and I've got your back. And it's been like that ever since.
And did you come to understand your dad and your mom later in life then and maybe why they were the way they were and not blame them for it?
Oh, I don't blame them at all. I mean, they were doing their best. But, you know, they met, my mom and dad met in 1947, having known nothing but depression and war. And so their lives were ruined in many ways. That generation had a hard time. And then afterward, there was austerity. There was no money. There was, everything was ruined. And so they, you know, they did their absolute best, but it was just an impossible time for those two people. Plus, they were a bit obsessed with, you know, making us middle class, which was so out of date by that point. You know, you needed to look forward rather than look back. And that's what frustrated me as a kid.
Yeah. And I gather, was it a tough enough upbringing in Birmingham too?
It was because of that family situation. You know what? There was this strange thing that if you were doing well at school because your family wanted you to, you had a target on your back. So it was rough anyway, very emotionally inarticulate society. Everything was settled with fighting rather than talking. And it was worse for us because we were respectable, which was a bad thing.
Okay. So I guess it toughened you up and gave you material as well, though, didn't it?
Yeah, Reacher's fights are me age 9, literally.
So listen, the new book is a collection of short stories, Safe Enough, and I think they're stories from down the years, and they're terrific and great twists in a lot of them. Is short stories where you kind of had your fun between Reacher?
Yeah, that's basically it. And there are 20 stories in the book, and I like them all. I'm proud of them all. But it was something that I never thought was kind of my thing. It's a bit like you. You know, you're a radio star. I bet you get asked to go and do emceeing at a charity dinner or a charity auction or something like that. And I bet you do it because you're a nice guy, and I bet you're very good at it. But you don't think of it as your actual job. And I felt a bit like that with short stories. I was a novel writer. I was asked to do these short stories, and I'm like, okay, yeah, great, let's do them. But it never seemed to me my main job. So I never thought of publishing them in a collection until a publisher said, hey, you know, these are pretty good. We should do that. And I was a little nervous about it, but I thought, yeah, okay, let's try it. So here we are. Let's see what people think.
Yeah, I think you have the tricks of good short stories and, you know, come in as late as possible into the story and all that kind of thing, because it is a particular art, isn't it? Come here. One of the stories is you assembling a cast of characters for a book, and then without giving too much away, it is while you're stoned. Is that true to life? Did you find that smoking marijuana helped the creative process?
Yeah, I do find that because it kind of straightens you out, empties your mind and lets you focus on, if you just drift, you end up focusing on what actually is the real problem here. What do you need to do next? It clarifies things for me. And, you know, it's up to people what they think of smoking weed, but I'm all in favor of it. I think it's a lot less harmful than drinking too much or using other drugs. So for me, it's a safety valve.
Okay, yeah. People are thinking, oh, this interview has taken a strange turn. I wasn't expecting this. But so the thing is, to put it in the colloquial parlance, you're a total stoner, aren't you?
I have been ever since 1969. And it's a lot easier now.
Yeah. It kind of might seem at odds with your productivity a bit.
Yeah, well, it shows that it can, you know, it doesn't lay waste to your life.
Yeah.
It's not 24/7, but it's something that you can use. It's like relaxation.
Yeah, and look, I'll just say to be responsible here, obviously that's not the case for everybody, and for some people it can be very problematic and everything. So this is kind of maybe a bit of a basic question, but what's the appeal for you of getting high? Or would you even be high? Is it just, are you just like a different version of normal for you?
It, in a funny way, I think that your brain can direct where it goes. And, you know, for instance, I just moved and I'm in a new house now and I'm learning how to work it. It's very complicated. All kinds of things are going wrong. So all day long, I'm worried about something. But then I'll light up and the worries fade away because I think I've trained myself to use it for relaxation, forget your troubles, focus on what is fun.
Okay. So it's not like you're not waking up in the morning sparking one up, like you're not stoned.
No.
Now it's more towards the end of the day. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a wake and bake. It's, you know, relaxation in the evening instead of
gotcha.
A gin and tonic.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You see, I get the impression, I was reading about you. You know, a lot of Brits go to America and they get into wellness and fitness and macrobiotic diets and all that, and they get worse than the kind of LA crowd themselves. That didn't happen to you when you went to America, did it?
No, it totally did not happen to me. My lifestyle is terrible. People look at me in America and think, you know, I'm just totally an idiot because I don't care what I eat. I don't do any exercise. I'm not into that at all. I'll take my chances according to what happens naturally.
Okay. And now we should say as well, in case people think we're encouraging illegal behavior, marijuana is kind of legal in your neck of the woods. So I know you said you just moved house. As I understood it, you're living next to Colorado, where marijuana is legal. You live in Wyoming, but you live or were living up a mountain in the middle of nowhere, essentially, were you?
Yeah, still got that place and still go there. But right now I'm in New York and it's really happening all over the U.S. Colorado, for sure. That was the first. And that is, you go downtown and there's like boutiques, you know, with menus. It's very civilized. And New York is now legal. New Jersey, pretty much everywhere is getting legal for two reasons. You can't stop it. And secondly, to organize it takes organized crime out of it, and it produces some tax revenue. So I think it's going to be practically everywhere pretty soon.
Yeah, and look, obviously there's two sides to that argument. We won't get into it now. So tell me about the house in Wyoming, though. Set the scene for me there, because it really, to me now, it's a bizarre setup.
Well, it is. I went there for the contrast. I'd lived in New York City, which is densely populated and very built up. And I want, what is the biggest contrast you can find? And the state of Wyoming is one of those rectangular states in the West. And physically, it is larger than the United Kingdom. And population-wise, it has the population of Belfast, say, spread thinly through it. And so it is incredibly isolated, incredibly lonely. My house is on the top of a little hill, and literally I will see nobody all day long unless I go out and seek somebody's company.
And does it not make life hard in a practical way, like the popping out to the shops and stuff like that?
Incredibly hard. There's no popping out. It's a 45-minute drive to buy food. So that's an hour and a half round trip on dirt roads, and you need a 4x4 to get there. And the winter is 8 months a year, often deep snow, blowing snow. Weather-wise, it's a nightmare, and distance is incredible. I've got a friend there, a writer, lives in Wyoming, and he said to me, I told him where I was moving to, and he said, oh, we're going to be neighbors. And I thought, wait a minute, are we? Have I read the map wrong? And he said, yeah, it's only 105 miles, close enough for dinner. And we've done that. 210-mile round trip to have dinner together. That's how it is out west. It's so different.
Okay. You see, there's a very sensible anxiety part of me going, I'm glad he's moved to New York, because the idea of an ambulance being able to get up there as he gets older is not going to make it. What is it in you that attracted you to this kind of extreme, do you think?
It's a strange thing being an immigrant to a country, because you don't have that built-in loyalty to any part, or you don't have any preconceptions about it. You want to explore the whole country, and you're always worried that you're having a great time where you are, but could it be better somewhere else? So I wanted to just try it and see. You know, we only get one life. Let's try as many experiences as we can.
Hilarious. FOMO moved you out to the middle of nowhere. So does living out there, or when you are out there, does it give you any insight into the divisions in America? Like, would I assume that a lot of your, quotes, neighbours out there are Trump people?
They are now. They're all solid right-wing people. And that's a great point, Brendan, because, yeah, in my experience, the one thing that divides America is population density. Do you live in an urban or metropolitan area, or do you live rural? And that is a massive, massive split. It's a sad split, because people are fundamentally the same everywhere. You've got these radical people in New York, like AOC, you know her, the congresswoman. And I know brisk, sensible women in Wyoming who will help you out if necessary. And the point is, if you swap those women over, if you put the Wyoming woman in New York and you put AOC in Wyoming, within a year, they would become the same people. They're just trying to help you out in the context of their community.
Okay.
So the illusion is bad, you know, that they're different, because they're really not.
Yeah, but it's back to your parents again, isn't it? That we are all products of our environment and our experiences, I suppose. Yeah. How would you be prepared to wade in on how the election will work out then, based on what you see?
Yeah, I mean, what I see is that there's a perception. Trump is still incredibly popular amongst the hardcore base, but that's not enough to win the election. So it all comes down to people in the middle. Then it comes down to the process of the vote counting and the vote challenging. It's not going to be simple. It's going to be very messy. But I believe that the mood is for moving away from the past. And I think Kamala Harris is popular. She's got momentum. In a normal election that just happens, you would expect her to win. But there's going to be all kinds of shenanigans and legal challenges and all kinds of stuff. It's going to be a mess. And people are aiming for November, thinking, you know, that is the date. Well, it's going to stretch beyond that. So we've got to be ready for a few months of intense back and forth.
I've seen also you predict big trouble in America in 2026.
Yeah, that's always on my mind because that's the 250th anniversary. And so, for instance, if Trump got in 2024 with a mad Republican Congress, there would be all kinds of laws focused around the anniversary, using that big anniversary as an excuse for bad things. So I think it is, if Trump gets in, it's going to be ugly around that period.
So Lee, are you retiring now, semi-retiring? We don't tend to think of writers retiring.
No, it's not a thing. You know, usually they work till they're dead and then carry on afterward with somebody else. But I love retirement. I just love the idea. You know, it's a very British thing. You go to school for a bit and then you work for a very long time.
Yeah.
And then you retire. It's a thing. You do retired guy things. And I want to do that. You know, why not?
Isn't it funny? Your parents struggled so hard to make you middle class, and there you are. You have that middle class bourgeois notion of, you know, a man does his time and then time for retirement. So do you write anymore? Will you write still?
Yeah, I do short stories now and then. I do articles for newspapers or magazines. Writing is something that you can't get away from. You just have a thought and you feel compelled. You've got to put it down in a form that is understandable and communicates. So I'm sure I'll always do that. I think retirement actually is a bit of an illusion. It's probably not going to happen 100%.
You're probably as well off. The more retired guys I meet, like, a lot of them are kind of seem to be slightly at a loose end. Do you have hobbies and stuff?
Reading is my main hobby, and that is the thing I'm doing mostly now, because when you write, you can't, obviously, while you're sitting there making up your own story, you can't be reading somebody else's. So I've got a huge, literally thousands of books that I haven't got to yet, and I'm looking forward to getting to them. Music is important to me as well. Then probably TV. There's a lot of things I need to catch up with. So what I won't be doing is playing golf or going to the gym or anything like that, because that is not me.
And listen, what better way to go into retirement than knowing exactly who you are and what is you and what isn't you? Well, listen, I hope you do more short stories, because you definitely have a great future as a short story writer. And safe enough, your short story collection is published by Penguin Random House and it's out now. Lee Child, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan. Appreciate it.